Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
XXX is brought to you by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter the offer code XXX at checkout to get 10% off. And by BowlandBranch.com, offering luxury bedding at affordable prices. Order right now and they'll give you 20% off plus free shipping. Get sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers, and more at BowlandBranch.com. That's BOLLANDBRANCH.com and use the promo code XXX. And by Harry's, the shaving company that offers German-engineered blades, well-designed handles, and shipping right to your door. Visit harrys.com for $5 off your first purchase with the promo code XXX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XXX Gabfest for Thursday, June 2nd.
The Empowertizing Edition.
I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
So before we get going on our show, we have a little apology to issue. Noreen, take it.
Yes, we had a letter from Robin Potter, listener Robin Potter, who feels that we often, and particularly last week, are a little insulting to stay-at-home moms. She writes, FYI, I've never watched Ellen, nor do I own any Lululemon, not even sure of the spelling, which I find very funny. I'm not either. I'm actually not sure of the pronunciation more than the spelling. Anyway, I actually don't have any stay-at-home mom, SAHM, friends that do either of these things. I'm not saying that they don't exist, but I think that you are stereotyping the stay-at-home moms. So, Robin, that was totally unintentional. And to other listeners, we really, really, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. as we'll talk about later on the show, I'm a choose your choice feminist, and I feel really badly about that. So I'm sorry that we've been doing that.
Do you think it's because of Ali Wong? Is that what put us in that direction? Like her whole entire riff, which is or isn't ironic about being a stay-at-home wife/mom.
Yeah, and I think that we were, the Ellen stuff and the Lululemon stuff, for the record, we were quoting bits from the Ali Wong show. So in that particular instance, I do think that that's where it came from. But if we've at other times unintentionally sort of denigrated people, we don't mean to.
I have to say, I do think there's definitely something in the air about where stay-at-home moms are one of the last groups that you can mock. I mean, not us, but people on television, like the Ali Wong, which was a fearless bit of stand-up, but also on sitcoms, this is a trope now, like they're the last group that you can sort of make fun of.
Which is a crazy reversal.
Right, exactly. It's a crazy reversal. It's upside down world from, you know, the beginnings of television. But I do think maybe that's what's going on.
Well, we should
talk
about
that. Okay, that's our topic.
Yeah,
exactly.
Seriously.
Exactly.
That's our topic for the future. All right, let's get going. Our first topic today is the commodification of feminism. Pop stars, actresses, and big corporations are all proud to be feminists now. But what does it mean when feminism becomes a brand identity? Is this a good thing or a bad thing? We talk about a new book by Andy Zeisler called We Were Feminists Once. And our second topic, 20 years after welfare reform, it's turned into something no one expected, a marriage counseling program. How on earth did this happen? And we have a Slate Plus segment today. June?
Yeah, in our Slate Plus segment this week, we'll discuss whether hobbies are sexist. And if you're not a Slate Plus member, you can start your free 2-week trial by visiting slate.com/xxplus.
I'm so excited for that segment. Okay. All right, celebrity feminism. You can see it everywhere. Beyoncé at the Video Music Awards, dancing in front of the neon billboard that said feminism. Emma Watson's speech at the UN on gender equality. Katy Perry, who described her perfume as royal, rebellious, and feminist. All of this has made feminism cool and fun and accessible, Andy Zeisler argues in her new book, We Were Feminists Once. But it's also made feminism depoliticized, decontextualized, and largely meaningless. All right, guys, why don't we give people examples of what Andy Zeisler is talking about so they can ground themselves? Like, besides celebrity feminism, what is it that she's describing as the big change that's happened in the last 10, 15 years?
I would say that the embrace of feminism as a concept by marketers is one example. So that you see ad campaigns celebrating empowered girls or even the word feminism in ways that would have been unthinkable a few years ago.
Empowertizing. That was one of the many buzzwords that came up in this book. Femvertizing and empowertizing.
Which is like the Dove campaign is the classic thing everyone always cites. Also, some Nike campaigns from the 90s, you know, telling girls that they could play too, all that kind of stuff.
And there are phases of this, right? It's not that every phase is the same, because like I remember the Anjali commercials, which is like you can bring home the bacon and fry it up in a pan, right? That was there's even before that, there was like the Virginia Slims cigarettes and feminism.
And Charlie, and then, I can still sing that Charlie slogan, jingle.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, I've got a little bit of a cold, but here's a fragrance that's here to stay and they call it Charlie.
Charlie. Yeah.
Yeah, I can never heard that before in my life, but I definitely remember the Nike commercials.
So the first phase, then there was like bring home the bacon, fry it up in the pan, but it was very much like for your man, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That was one. That was like the 80s phase. Like you can be the perfect woman for your man. And then later the men dropped out of the picture and it was like you're a liberated single girl. And that started with just like the yogurty commercials, you know, like you're just running through the fields eating your yogurt. It was like the single girl moment. And the Wonder Bra ad, I love that one. That was very interesting.
What was the Wonder Bra ad again?
The Wonder Bra ad was like the ironic ad, like, look at these boys. It was like, we're so over. It was like post-feminist irony.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there came the empowerment phase, which is, I think, the one we're still in now.
Although she says that empowerment has changed a little bit, right? Now it's about individual empowerment a little more directly than it used to be. It's about finding your own creativity and your own niche.
Mm-hmm. So, for example?
Well, I think you could go back to the Dove thing, you know, to celebrate your freckles.
Right. Dove, celebrate your freckles. Wait, as opposed to the Nike kind of big, broad gender equality for girls kind of vibe?
Right. It's more, it's taking it even farther away from sort of women as a broad group and more looking at one woman and all the possibilities of what this one woman can have.
Right. So this is, we're now into choice feminist advertising.
Or Spanx, for instance, are not just choice feminism, but power feminism. A lot of the Spanx advertising centers around like you becoming a more powerful person in the workplace by not having visible panty lines, which is the big thing separating women from their hopes and dreams in the boardrooms.
High heels and visible panty lines. Yeah, that's my big problem at NPR. People have brought that up in my HR reviews, is the visible panty lines. Can you imagine if that actually came up? Well, ma'am, I think what's getting in the way of your promotion here is your panty lines.
You can't tell HR about it.
Okay, so I don't know where to start. Like, what did you, were you guys convinced by this idea? Should we start at celebrity feminism or should we start at marketing? Or do you think they're one and the same? I feel like those are two separate topics.
I think they're separate. I think we've kind of covered marketing.
Yeah.
Celebrity feminism is interesting because it's sort of a good measure of whether feminism is cool or not in any given moment. And the takeaway of this is that at some point, maybe 2014, maybe a little earlier, something shifted and it became cool. So celebrities who previously were not identifying as feminists, like Taylor Swift, for instance, all of a sudden, you know, the Katy Perry's of the world and the Taylor Swift's of the world were coming out as feminist, and maybe Beyonce was the turning point there. But I think celebrities are just interesting insofar as they and their brand managers and whatever gurus are sort of advising them stick a finger up into the wind, maybe, or not even purposely do that. Just, you know, maybe they are just absorbing what's in the culture. And so they're just an easy stand-in for how hot is feminism right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I mean, Andy Zeisler is making a bigger argument, which is that they steal it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Like they absorb it and steal it so that it becomes meaningless, mainstream, and a substitute for actual feminism. So the way you're describing it, it's pretty innocuous. They're just a measure of what's happening in the world. The way she's describing it is that used to be true, but now it's the thing that's happening instead of the real thing.
Right. And her argument is that they steal the sort of glossy parts. They steal the words, you know, Beyonce walking out on stage just to the word feminist, while also, you know, walking around in you know, a skin tight outfit that someone else might not consider feminist.
I thought it was more that Beyonce's, she doesn't care about the skin tight necessarily. It's more that she, you know, she's not, the system hasn't changed in any way for women. The system of celebrity, the system of Hollywood, it's just that the word has been embraced with no change underneath.
And that, to me, is the like my big problem with the book. Like, I mean, what did you expect? What else would, you know, it's, of course, you know, celebrities, no matter how wonderful they are, let's just, what, you know, just do our compulsory Beyoncé is God, you know, reference this episode.
Goddess, honey.
That's
Goddess.
Right. But they're celebrities, you know, they're not the thinkers. They're not the leaders of the movement. You know, it's just the for me, the big problem with the book is sort of setting up these things which, you know, to me are not all that surprising. There's nothing that really seems all that insightful to me. It's like rehearsing these things that any feminist would recognize, all even as much as she might enjoy, you know, seeing celebrities discuss whether or not they're feminists. Nobody who would read a book like this would think that that solved the problems of feminism. Nobody would think that seeing an ad that uses the word feminist means that women now have reproductive rights. But the book doesn't actually, it just sort of says how these things are not what we need, but it never gets to what we need.
I also think that, I think she sees more harm in it than I do.
Mm.
I get, I'm turned off by advertising that pretends to be feminist. I'm annoyed by celebrity co-option. I am. I agree with her. But I think the degree is where I differ from her. I think it's not – I think it's annoying but not actually harmful and maybe a little bit good that celebrities are all saying they're feminist. Like if it leads someone to Google it and maybe leads them down a certain, you know, path. She even at one point says – college girls told her that Beyonce was a gateway drug for feminist texts, which I think is funny, but probably totally true. So it's not, I mean, I think she's right that if this becomes the sum total of what's going on, but I think it's maybe just one part of what's going on. And yes, it is what gets the most attention because that's the way our culture works. Unfortunately, we live in a celebrity media economy, but there are things I'm more upset about in the world.
Right. And these people are not the people who caused the problem. You know, essentially, she has issues with capitalism. Hey, so do I. But she doesn't then say, so let's have a socialist revolution or let's dot, dot, dot. Like, there's nothing at the end of the ellipsis. You know, capitalism is a real problem for women. But she doesn't offer any solutions, or it's just kind of problem naming. And that, you know, I don't mean to be too negative on the book. I find her quite a, you know, she's a very readable writer. She manages to do that thing where she has voice without it being annoying. All of that, it's I don't think this book is for me. And that is a problem that I often have with books like this. So who is it for? Who is going to read this book? Because for it, to me, it's like, if I had never seen the sea and somebody said, hey, you know what, that water over there, that's salty, my mind would be blown. Salty, wow. But if I swam in it every day, I'd be like, yeah, duh. Well, so like, is this book for people who don't know the sea, or is it for
people who've dipped a toe in the water, maybe?
Okay.
And you and I kind of live on the feminist internet, and we have to brainstorm stuff about this all the time.
Right.
So none of this is totally new to us, but if you're a more casual observer of the feminist blogosphere, say, or not even, you know, really reading it, some of the stuff might be fresher to you. And what she does do is she marshals it all together in service of this larger argument, basically that feminism needs to be movement feminism, not post-feminism, not choice feminism, not power feminism or marketplace feminism, but just movement, like orthodox feminism.
Yeah, see, I totally enjoyed it, June, because I like the little parsings of this pop culture versus that pop culture. Like, I was thinking, oh, Beyonce deserves it because not because she stands in front of the word feminism, but because she owns her own brand. You know, that's pretty great. She's not controlled by anyone. She's her own manager. I think that's, you know, it made me think of the differences. Like, why did Katherine Hagel, when she complained about Judd Apatow's movies being sexist, get swallowed up, whereas Beyonce doesn't get swallowed up for saying stuff like that? I mean, I just like the, like, tiny minutiae of pop culture parsing, because I don't really do that myself to that degree of obsessiveness. So I thought that was interesting. But I agree with your ellipsis critique. Like, what's at the other end of that ellipsis? Like, it's not, you know, the usual... they're taking away our reproductive rights. Why aren't we worrying about that? To me, it's like a deeper critique of why these changes are happening. Because the celebrities, like you said, they're just like reflecting what's happening in the culture more broadly. Do you guys remember Susan Faludi's piece in Baffler about capitalist feminism?
No.
It was more about Sheryl Sandberg.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the deeper critique, right? That it's this like self-actualization, you know, rise to the top of the existing patriarchal hierarchy. It's the deeper critique of this kind of feminism, which just values success in a kind of male way, which doesn't challenge the system at all.
Yeah. You know? This is like the debate between Hillary voters and Bernie voters. Like she's advocating for a Bernie voter kind of systemic change. And I found myself playing the Hillary Clinton part in my head and being like, can't we just make incremental change within the system? Even though in other contexts, like reading the Faludi essay, I was like, right on. I hate capitalist feminism, you know?
But it's tricky too because of this peculiar moment that we're in where there is, I mean, not just on feminist blogs, but it is very easy to find really right on feminist takes on things that are happening in the news. Like, you know, okay, I'll blow Slate's home, but there's stuff in XX every day that is really, I think, deep sort of analysis of, you know, applying a feminist lens and finding misogyny and, you know, just identifying what's going on in various sort of situations in the news. That kind, and it's in other places too, that kind of critique, that kind of awareness is much more present than it ever has been. And feminism, you know, the word feminism is not, I think, the dirty word it once was. However, we also are at a time when reproductive rights are genuinely under pressure. And so many measurements of women's progress are moving in the wrong direction. So there is this weird tension of, it's not only that celebrities are saying feminist and that's bad, it's that all kinds of things are happening, that there is more awareness, that there's more consciousness, and yet simultaneously rights are being removed rather than added. And that is a peculiar contradiction. And it's not because of the embrace, the sort of superficial embrace of feminism. It's something else. It is systemic. And it is, you know, as one of the reviewers said, she never mentions Republicans. Like, this is kind of, Republicans have more to blame for a lot of the situations that women are in, that are just the political system generally, than the fact that, you know, an advertiser chooses to co-opt a political concept, because that's what advertisers do.
Well, she brought that up and then didn't. She sort of said, even while we're in this golden age of feminist TV or whatever, you know, things she was celebrating, you know, this is happening as a parallel kind of thing.
Right.
And I wish she had sort of leaned in a little more to saying that they are related, because I think you could make that argument if you really wanted to go out there. You could sort of say, you know, I think it's pretty obvious that what some people in America think is under attack is a certain traditional way of life, set of values, way of seeing male and female roles. And if you turn on the TV and all you see celebrated are, you know, liberated women — that's such an old-fashioned term to use in this context, but I don't know, empowered women — there might be something, you know, at work on your psychology that makes you want to get on board with rolling back rights for women. I don't know. I think that's an interesting connection, that it would have been maybe too provocative to explore. Maybe there's no evidence for that, but
no, but that's Susan Faludi's argument and backlash. Yeah. That's what backlash is. It's the argument that as women get closer and closer, at the moment that they're, you know, that they perceive, that the culture starts to perceive them as close to the top or liberated, that's when you get the biggest backlash.
And she goes through the backlash era, but in sort of a pop culture way, kind of looking at what's the Bunny Boiler movie?
Fatal
Attraction and The Witches of Eastwick.
That seemed like a very unsatisfying section to me, because all of the examples were so old.
Yeah.
And I mean, now that you've said, oh, that was meant to be a historical, something like, oh, okay. It just felt like, what, there were no more recent examples? You know, I didn't quite make that connection.
So I want to talk about other movements and people to blame besides the Republicans. But before we do that, let's thank our first sponsor.
XX is brought to you by Squarespace. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, it's all possible with a Squarespace website. I think we have all had that moment where we're so used to working on professional sites where everything's done for you, that when it's time to make a site for yourself, it feels really impossible because, oh my goodness, are you going to have to use HTML? Do they still use HTML? It all just feels very overwhelming. But Squarespace has features that make it all doable in a snap. Creating a website with Squarespace is a simple, intuitive process. You can add and arrange your content and features with the click of a mouse. Squarespace makes adding a domain to your site simple, and if you sign up for a year, you'll receive a custom domain for free for that year. You can design a best-in-class online store with Squarespace's award-winning templates, customizable settings, and more, all without a single plugin. So start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter offer code XX to get 10% off your first purchase. That's squarespace.com and enter offer code XX to get 10% off your first purchase. Back to you, Hannah.
All right. So the Republicans, that's an easy one to blame for the lack of organized feminist politics making any progress. Did you guys read Nathan Heller's story about campus politics in this week's New Yorker?
Absolutely. That's my recommendation this week, actually.
Yeah, good. It's such a great story. But I was thinking about that when I read Andy Zeisler's book, because it seems that something about the way political activism is happening on campus politics resists being unified into a single feminist movement. Hmm. You know, he writes about intersectionality. It's like a lack of desire to be funneled into kind of one feminism that's perceived as white and middle class. You know, it just seems more dispersed and, you know, choicey.
Well, that's, I mean, that is a very interesting insight. I do think, though, that this is something that's always been an issue. I don't know if it's a problem, but it's always been there in the feminist movement. There's never really been a unified movement. There was Now for a while, but obviously there were issues around Now, especially in the early days around lesbians, to a certain extent around women of color. There was NARAL, there's Planned Parenthood, but those, you know, there's never really been a political party, for example, or just something that people go on marches for certain, you know, thing when things are under threat. But it's always been tricky to have so what are we going to do? Like, there were the original demands of the women's liberation movement that I'm old enough to remember, but there's not like we've ever had a sort of, you know, go to a meeting on Tuesday every week and you know, work for the revolution. And how the challenges to that have changed maybe now, but I don't know that there was ever a time that we were all agreed and we all sort of were on the same page about how to organize to change things.
I know, but reading those kids, didn't you get the feeling like the things that were moving them were things that had to do with identity and experience, and they were fairly subjective? And I couldn't see how you could funnel all those women, men. Well, actually, they were very anti-gender binary, so I don't know why I said women, men. Humans, people, like, into a single movement that's like a pro-choice movement. It just didn't, it seemed so far away from the things that were occupying their minds.
Yeah, and, you know, it occurs to me as you say this that you could actually argue that this is kind of the inevitable end to choice feminism, to the cult of the individual that Andy Zeisler sees tied up with the empowerment feminism of the last 15 years, right? If you've been raised in that environment where it's all about what you as an individual achieve as a woman or you know, in whatever identity you're exploring there, maybe you don't want to be part of a unified movement necessarily. Maybe it is just your individual identity politics that you're exploring.
Right, right. So that's another thing that she doesn't discuss.
Right.
Can I run one more by you guys?
Absolutely.
So Andy Zeisler, founder of Bitch Magazine, wrote a lot about riot girl culture. Where is that counterculture?
You know, nowadays?
It's like Megan. Yeah, it's like Megan Trainor, who's, you know, our feminine. Like, where is
No, that's not
the
true.
Girl?
That's there are the rookie girls. There's Lena Dunham. I think there are a lot of sort of alternative. I'm sure there are plenty more that I don't know about because I'm old, you know. But I don't think that Megan Trainor is like the Spice Girls to the Riot Girls is. You know, she's what is reaching, you know, a middle schooler's bedroom in a lot of America, but there are also people listening to, I don't know, Willow Smith. I don't know. Is Willow Smith? I think Willow Smith is pretty woke. people should write in and tell me like what cool young feminist teens are listening to. But I think like there is a counterculture, don't you think?
I don't know. Maybe this is something for our listeners to write in and tell us.
Well, what does your daughter listen to? Who are her like?
I don't know where the alternative, like feminism is alive in the high schools. Mm-hmm. I see that. It is really remarkable. They're interested in, you know, just deep feminist reading and history and, you know, the old greats, and they want to know everything about feminism, and they eat it up and they see everything through a feminist lens. But it's not exactly a counterculture. You know, like, I don't know where its music is or its movies. I mean, maybe you're right. We just need people to write in and correct us, because you're right. We're all too old to know this. but I do like, what if we look back at this moment, is there going to be a kind of live, active feminist counterculture, alternative culture for people to tap into?
I don't know. I was thinking a little bit about how Lenny, which our dear friend Jess Gross works for Lenny, and it is, you could argue that it's part of sort of alt feminist culture, but yet it's also like a lifestyle site. Mm-hmm. You know, they're selling totes now, and I wonder if in this era, everything is just so capitalist that even the alternative, although it's always been that way,
right.
I guess.
I mean, I think back, I was on the Off Our Backs Collective, you know, in the 1980s. The tagline was a radical feminist news journal. And, I experienced a lot of the feelings that are motivating Andy Zeisler, where, you know, working at a magazine like that, it's really hard work. It is not remunerated. The Off Our Backs Collective was a volunteer collective. It was part of our movement work, and we had our straight jobs to support it. But the things that you do, you're always aware that, like, the real work is like in women's shelters, or the real work is, you know, doing clinic, you know, helping people get into clinics. There's always that tension between just sort of pointing out the negatives and doing something, you know. And of course, writing a book like this is activism. Starting a magazine like Bitch is activism. Working on the Off Our Backs Collective is activism. But it's also a little bit about, you know, the words that you're spreading are about how terrible things are. And the hard part is, you know, what to do with that.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. She at various points defines what, you know, sort of the feminist agenda should be. And it's pretty expansive, you know, not just sort of workplace equality, more family leave time. It also includes things like prison reform. But the one sort of line in the sand she says that we have to still draw is on the question of abortion, basically, or reproductive rights. And I wonder how you guys feel about that. I have to say that I bristled a little bit at that. Because I think that there are a lot of, if you look at the way abortion polls in America, a lot of people have these feelings that are sort of in the middle and complicated. And that doesn't mean that they're advocating, even if they wouldn't identify as proudly pro-choice, that doesn't mean they're advocating to, like, roll back women's access to clinics and Planned Parenthood. That just means they think it's a complicated moral issue. And to sort of draw that line in the sand and say, you can't stand with us, that felt to me like at odds with some other things that she was saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you think in your head that you're only excluding, you know, Republican women in the middle of the country. You're also excluding a lot of African Americans and Latinas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's lots of church going people who do not believe in abortion, who are not, you know, who are people you might want in your movement.
Yeah. And just that whole thing of saying, okay, you can't call yourself this label. You can't apply this label if you don't believe in a woman's right to control her reproductive reproduction. But I kind of believe that too, but I also worry about, like, that doesn't mean that then I don't want anything to do with women who, if that disqualifies them, then I don't want, like, doesn't mean that if they can't call themselves feminists, I don't want to do work with them. Of course I do. I'm still in solidarity with a great deal of their views. We don't kind of overlap in one particular Venn diagram.
I think it, like, it makes it more of an issue than it needs to. Like, it provokes people on the mm-hmm, other side. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It makes it feel like this is the only thing that this movement is about, and it diverts attention in the same way we've been obviously it's something that is under attack in this country and it's valuable to draw attention to it. But I do think there is, like, in the same way that the right fundraises on this issue and the left fundraises on mm-hmm. this issue, basically. And if we really wanted to put our, I think there is, like, some kind of jujitsu move where you could figure out a way to get the attention away from this.
Yeah. I'm all, you know, my greatest political insight is Sinead O'Connor, when she ripped up the picture of the Pope and said, fight the real enemy. Like, it's all about fighting the real enemy. And people with whom
June, as a Catholic, I am obligated to step in here and say that Pope Francis has been a great friend to...
She didn't rip up Pope Francis. She ripped up John Paul II. But... yeah, you know, that you don't make enemies or you don't sort of fight with among yourselves. Like, let's fight the people who hate us. Let's not, like, have infighting. Let's focus on the people who want to take away our rights. And I do think that I agree with you, Noreen, that a lot of it is a distraction from the real issues that we need to focus on.
This is just like our feelings on feminism now.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's very cathartic for us.
It is. I was just about, like, my big, if I were to choose a feminist cause for 2015, it's our next topic. It would be the
2016.
Massive, 2016, it would be the massive rise in struggling single mothers.
Absolutely.
Like, that's so much more important.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that in a second. But last question on this topic. Noreen, you started by describing yourself as what kind of feminist? Choice?
I guess I'm a choice feminist. I don't know. It was very interesting for me to read this book because I realized how much I am a product of all of these campaigns. That I sort of came of age with the Nike ad and watched Sex and the City at what, in retrospect, was a very tender age, you know, that I absorbed all of these lessons. And I would say, like,
and what's wrong with that?
Well, right. And I think that, I don't know. I think my understanding and relationship to feminism has certainly deepened over the years, but it did start with stupid stuff like the Lilith Fair CD my mom bought me, you know? And so I just think that not, you know, people are going to have different relationships to it over their life. But yes, I think I was informed by these texts in ways that I still maybe don't even understand. She does a lot of criticism of neoliberals in here. And I really did a lot of soul searching about just how neoliberal am I and how did I never realize this before? How would you describe yourself? Are you post-feminist, Hannah?
No.
You're feminist.
Can I just be a feminist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
I don't think I'm a post-feminist. So listeners, don't write in and tell us what kind of feminist you are, because that will be hard to parse. But I would be interested in people's first exposure to feminism. Like, was it a pop culture figure? Was it a book that your mom or your dad gave you? Was it something that you learned in school? I'm very curious about that. Again, we're talking about the book We Were Feminists Once by Andy Zeisler. You should check it out. Now we're going to move on to our second topic, which is welfare reform. Before we do that, Noreen, why don't you give us our second ad?
The XX Gabfest is also brought to you by Bowl and Branch. So it's a new season. It's officially summer. And I have been thinking that I would love nothing more in my life than a fresh set of summer linens. To me, that just, like, it evokes, like, the seaside and just every bit of cool, refreshing, you know, white, soft. So if you, like me, have been thinking about this, craving this, why don't you try out some sheets from Bowl and Branch? Bowl and Branch has cut out the middleman, markups, and the chain store mentality to deliver luxury sheets for a fraction of the price you'd pay elsewhere. You can only get their sheets in one place. That's bowlandbranch.com, where you know you're paying for quality and not department store overhead. Go online to Bowl and Branch, that's B-O-L-L and branch.com, and use the promo code XX, and they'll let you try them risk-free for 30 nights. If you don't absolutely love them, you can send them back. You literally have nothing to lose. So there's also promo code, which is great. You can go to bowlandbranch.com and enter D-O-U-B-L-E-X, and you'll get 20% off your whole order. Sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers, everything to make your summer perfect and crisp and refreshing. So don't wait. Go to rollandbranch.com today and use promo code XX for 20% off your entire order.
All right, let's move on to our second topic, welfare reform. 20 years after welfare reform, it's turned into something no one expected, a marriage counseling program and a fairly ineffective one, and also a very small part of our social safety net. And the people who suffer the most are women. We have on today Chrissy Clark, who wrote a great series for Slate about welfare reform 20 years later. Hi, Chrissy.
Hi.
So I have a question for you. I remember when the Oklahoma marriage program first came to light, it was at the beginning of welfare reform. And people wrote about it at the time, but I just assumed it was like a small, minor part of how states were using the money.
Yeah, and in some ways it is. I mean, in Oklahoma, it takes up about 5% of the TANF block grant overall, or of TANF spending, temporary assistance for needy family spending in the state. But what you need to remember is put that in perspective. So the thing that we kind of think of as welfare, giving money to poor families who live in poverty, that takes up only 9% of the TANF block grant in Oklahoma. So you're comparing 5% of the budget to 9% of the budget, or $9 million versus $18 million a year, sort of most recently. So yes, it's a small piece, but what I think has gotten less attention is that what is also a really small piece is what we all think of when we think of welfare, which is giving money to poor people to help them make ends meet and just sort of cover their basic needs.
And why?
Why are we in this strange world now?
Like, how did this happen? I mean, we think of welfare as giving money to needy families. So how did it become not that?
Yeah. So in 1996, when we passed, I can't even say the acronym, and I don't feel bad because none of the policy wonks that I've interviewed can pronounce it either. PRORWA, the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, basically welfare reform. When we passed that, what it did is it turned what had been a so-called entitlement program, a program where basically the federal government spent as much every year on cash assistance as there were families who applied and qualified for the program. We turned it from that into a capped chunk of money that we distributed to states every year. And the bill was very long and very complicated, but what it didn't spend a whole lot of time doing is delineating exactly what states could do with that money. It basically boiled down these four purposes kind of at the top of the bill, these four things that states could do with the money that were very broad. And two of them involved what we kind of think of as welfare, cash assistance to poor families and getting families into the job market. And then the last two purposes focus really specifically on marriage. And this didn't get a whole lot of headlines at the time, but it ended up opening up this door for states to spend the money in all of these very different ways that have very little to do with what we think of when we think of welfare.
Can you do a quick rundown of what some of the wildest of those ways might be? There's marriage counseling that you mentioned, but also I was sort of shocked to learn that in Michigan, there's a program where college kids whose families make more than $250,000 to get scholarships to college, and that's covered under this program, right?
Yeah, and even sort of more bizarrely, that is... So every time a state spends this money, they need to justify it under one of these four purposes. And so Michigan gives their justification for spending money on these college scholarships for private schools. They justify that by saying that it helps prevent out-of-wedlock pregnancies.
Oh, my God.
And the reaction that you just had when I was talking to folks in Michigan and saying, wait, connect the dots for me. Like, I'm not seeing the connection there. And they would all laugh too. And they would say, yeah, you know, you don't have to connect the dots. Like, you basically just say, we are invoking purpose four or we are invoking purpose three. And you don't need to say much more than that. You kind of have to check a box. So those were some of the ones that really startled me when I read them, especially because a lot of that money, or at least a significant chunk of that money, is going to families who don't consider themselves particularly needy, you know, in the case of the marriage counseling classes or in the case of the these college scholarships. Some of them go to poor families, but some of them go to very well-off families who are glad for a little extra help in sending their kids to college, but would not consider themselves needy. There's other things, and then there's other things that you might think, yeah, this might help poverty. There's money, actually in Michigan, I think also in Louisiana, that goes to the pre-K programs, money that goes to, a lot of money goes into the foster care system in different states. But what ends up happening is that money, or those programs, used to be funded by the state. And now a big chunk of that money is instead, or a big chunk of that funding is instead coming from this federal welfare block grant. And so what you end up kind of doing is robbing Peter to pay Paul, where you are supplanting state funds. So you're not actually enhancing anything. You're just taking federal money, and then it frees up the state to spend, to use their budget for other things, or to lower taxes and just kind of shrink the overall coverage. One other program that definitely was surprising to me, and not a lot of money goes to it, but in a handful of states, funding goes to crisis pregnancy centers, so-called crisis pregnancy centers.
Wow.
Which, if you're not familiar with them, kind of are centers that try to counsel women to avoid having an abortion. And that's actually invoked in the purpose that they claim in TANF, that under which they are justified in using this money, is to encourage. I think there's some sort of gymnastics in the contract where they say, we are encouraging the formation of one parent families, which could lead to two parent families. So there's a lot of acrobatics that go on now in terms of justifying why they're using the money for different things.
You say in your Thursday piece that states are collectively spending just about a quarter of the TANF money on actual cash assistance to poor families, and less than a quarter is being spent on childcare and work supports to help those families find jobs. And I wondered if you have any information at all about whether states that spend more on cash assistance and work supports have any better results about reducing poverty or increasing employment rates in their states. I mean, do we know that if people get more cash payments and just get more access to supports that help them get a job, a real job, not just a job that they have to get to qualify for the payments, that it really kind of is a path out of dependency, which I guess was the original intention of this reform?
Yeah, that is such a good question. And I wish I had a clean answer for you. I think that it gets really murky because, you know, poverty. So, for example, New York and California are two states that do spend, I think, more than 30% of their welfare dollars on cash assistance. And they have poverty rates that are sort of right around the average in across the country, I think like 15 or 16%, which is way better than some other states in the country that can go up to 19 or 20%. The issue is, you know, the economies in California and New York, so many things are going on with them that affect their poverty rate as opposed and their employment rate. So I think it's hard to kind of unbraid all of that. Mm-hmm. But one thing that I think a lot of people have realized in these 20 years after welfare reform is not a whole lot of study has actually been done on, like, so what is happening to poor families now, and where are they going, and how does cash assistance help them or not? I think that there was sort of this sense, when I've talked to a lot of researchers and policy wonks, there was this sense that after we reformed welfare and passed that bill, it was like, okay, we can check that off the box. We fixed welfare. And there wasn't necessarily a whole lot of looking at, well, how many people are getting jobs out of this? And are they climbing out of poverty? I think that a concern that both, a sort of a bipartisan concern among Republicans and Democrats, even those who were very intimately involved in the architecture of welfare reform, there are studies that show that, especially among single women, single mothers, a lot of them did find work after welfare reform, and did increase their earnings in and go into the labor market. But then there was this like persistent and growing group of people at the very bottom who were no longer receiving welfare and weren't finding jobs. And so there's there's this group at the bottom who really just kind of fell through all of the cracks. And I think that that has been really troubling to people.
Well, Chrissy, that was a great series. Thank you for doing it.
Oh, thank you so much for talking to me about it.
Sure. And everyone should check it out on Slate. It's called Oh My God, We're on Welfare, and includes personal testimonies from women and kinds of women you wouldn't expect who are on welfare. Thank you, Chrissy.
Thanks so much.
Let's move on to our next topic. But before we do that, let's hear from our next sponsor.
The XX Gabfest is also brought to you by Harry's. There's a certain holiday coming up, Father's Day. I hear that involves quite a bit of shopping. And may we recommend the Harry's Shaving Set, which makes a perfect Father's Day gift. It looks cool, it feels special, and it's something that Dad will actually use. The limited edition Father's Day Shave Set includes a matte black razor handle, a chrome razor stand, Harry's moisturizing foaming shave gel, and three of Harry's handcrafted blade cartridges, and a travel cover. Good grief. All for $40. Plus, it comes in a sleek, giftable box with the option to add custom engraving and a personalized card. You can order online to avoid the hassle of going to the store to pick up a gift. Plus, shipping in the US is free for all Harry's shave sets. Go to harrys.com right now and redeem a special offer for fans of the show. Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase with the promo code XXDOUBLEX. Don't wait. Free shipping for Father's Day ends on Friday, June 3rd, so act now. That's HARRYS.com. Enter code XX at checkout to get $5 off. Get Dad something he'll actually use this Father's Day.
Excellent. All right, recommendations. June, I like how you started that, like, I've heard there are fathers. Like, that's some heteronormative, like, you have a father.
Father?
All right, Noreen, you go first.
I'm going to recommend what I think is a great summer in the park, maybe going to the beach read. But it's not trashy, exactly. It's a novel called Sweet Bitter by Stephanie Dandler. It's just out pretty recently, I believe. And it's a story of a young woman who moves to New York in the late what are we calling that? The 2008-2009 era. Which is not so far from when I moved to New York. And she works in a fancy restaurant in Union Square. Whoa. And she gets sort of all the details right of the current food culture obsession in New York City. And there's sort of a love triangle in there that is less compelling to me than just the way she paints the scene. And she's got a great eye for detail. So Sweet Bitter by Stephanie Dandler.
Sounds great. All right, my recommendation is out of my usual box, Archie Comics. Mm-hmm. So I was commissioned to write a piece about Betty and Veronica updated, because there's a new Betty and Veronica series. Uh-huh. And so I started to reach the new Archie Comics. I love them. Like, everyone in my household reads comics. The boys do all the time. You know, I've read graphic novels, I've read Alison Bechdel, but this is just such a delight. Like, the Betty and Veronica you remember from your youth are completely gone. There's a new Betty and Veronica, and they have all these high school antics and this, like, dramatic story. And I was so into it, and then I gave it to David, and he was so into it. Anyway, read the new Archie comics.
Amazing.
So fun. Yeah. Okay, June.
So, as I mentioned earlier, I want to recommend Nathan Heller's piece in the May 30th New Yorker called The Big Uneasy. It's about the state of campus life at Oberlin College. And, you know, what I really liked about the piece, I mean, Nathan's an amazing writer. He's a friend of all of us and a friend of the magazine, is that he represents, I think, the whole picture very fairly. You know, he gives what some people would read as, oh my God, these kids are so spoiled. But then he also talks to those kids And he, I think, really uncovers some insight into, you say you want to broaden the community of your school, and yet you seem to freak out when the people who you admit are a different kind of student don't behave the way the traditional kind of students act. And that's just one example of the way that I think he represents and manages to get people to sort of present their point of view in a way that I think gives a broader sense of what's going on in campuses like Oberlin than other stories that I've seen about, which usually trade in the, can you believe these kids today kind of approach. And so I really enjoyed Nathan's piece.
I agree. It's completely changed my thinking. I actually read it a couple of times because I really wanted to understand like what the contradictions were and how these kids were thinking. It was really, really helpful. Okay. Thanks to our producer this week, Audrey Quinn. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Steve Lichtai. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. And our intern is Daniel Schrader. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. For more information about the show, our show page is slate.com/xx. Facebook page is facebook.com/XXGabFest. Or email us at XXGabFest@slate.com. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you in 2 weeks. It's a cruel, cruel